It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are talking about the goal-shy Gunners, finding out which team's fans got free beers from their rivals, and we'll be debating replays. Should they stay or should they be scrapped? Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have two of the finest football writers in the land, Alison Rudd and Martin Hardy, and a former footballer whose first FA Cup appearance saw him line up alongside Des Walker and Wes Morgan in a Nottingham Forest defence that kept a clean sheet in a 1-0 win against West Brom. Gregor Robertson is with us too. Now, that story came out in a piece that we ran at the weekend, Gregor, where you also revealed that you used to do a quiz before before every FA Cup game under Paul Hart. Is that right?
Yeah. Paul Hart was the academy director as well, and that was like his little tradition. And then when he got the first team job, he continued doing that, and that was kind of... It's a small thing, but it was like something that marked it out as different.
Was it an FA Cup related quiz? Was it like a quiz of the year? Was it a football quiz? Or
it was always football related, yeah. A guy called Andy Beasley, who was the goalkeeper coach, who was the quiz master, and he took some stick as well.
Yeah.
But it was very competitive.
Did your success in the quiz dictate whether you got in the team or not? So like if you finished in the bottom?
No, it wasn't that important, no. But it was, yeah, like I say, it was just something that made... be a little bit different when the FA Cup came around, really.
Excellent. I'm going to remind you of that next time I do any quiz questions and you kick off about it. To the Emirates then, to start with our FA Cup reactions, where Arsenal had 48 shots in the past two home games and have failed to score a single goal. Losing on Sunday 2-0 against Liverpool, Mikel Arteta said his players might now have a mental barrier around scoring. So after only one win in seven, are the wheels coming off at Arsenal, Alison Rudd?
Well, it's interesting. He's allowing that talk in, I think, about it being a mental block. Because if you talk about a mental block, you grow the mental block, I think. And then the players who didn't know they had a mental block are thinking, oh, I might have a mental block. And then it gets worse. But why would you have a mental block? Because there's nothing nicer than scoring. What's to be scared of? It's very strange, I think, the whole idea that highly competent, well-paid, fated strikers suddenly en masse become unable to think straight. And that's the point, isn't it? You're not supposed to think if you're a top class striker. You're supposed to be a finely oiled machine that when you're played in or the cross comes in or whatever the moment is, you've practiced it so much that you're very relaxed about having a pop at goal.
Do you think they have a top class striker?
They're not rubbish, are they?
Not top class though.
Well, by definition, they're not at the moment because they're not scoring goals. Yeah. But I think there are a number of players there who are capable of being that. I mean, we've seen someone like... We've seen Eddie Nketiah, come off the bench and score 3 in 10 minutes or something. I mean, we've seen players... Gabriel Jesus was never meant to be your out-and-out striker. He was meant to be more than that, but also have an intelligent strike on him. I mean, there are the TV commentary on Sunday highlighted Kai Havertz and how he takes an extra touch when he probably shouldn't. But I don't think they're all taking an extra touch when they shouldn't. It's just that if you're not in the groove, I mean, being a striker is about being selfish and comfortable in yourself. And if they're not, then it's... You can still be a top-class striker and have an off month, I think. No? Do you think, by definition, they're not top-class strikers at the moment? But I think they're all... Anyone who's playing there is capable of it.
Period. I think they're very good, but not top class. It was interesting, the quote from Arteta afterwards, when he said finishing is probably the hardest thing to replicate in football in terms of coaching. He said the timing, the behaviour of the opponent, the distance between the ball and the feet of the opponent. So it's an element that he can't quite get into the players, and I would suggest they're not quite good enough. Gabriel Jesus leaves Man City because Man City want an upgrade to win the European Cup, which they did. The problem, which Tom alludes to in terms of his unravelling, because it was perceived at the end of last season, oh, they need a dominant centre midfielder, which they bought. That hasn't made much difference. There was concerns about their defence. Now there isn't. Arteta seems to be getting more and more excitable during this period, and you might want him to be a little bit calm, which is where the mental situation pressure quote that he puts on top of his own players. But the bottom line is, they don't necessarily have the very, very world-class players up front to take them to that next step. But then you look at the Premier League and you say, does the Premier League have top-class forwards anymore? And Dominic Solanke is the third top scorer in the country. And in 2008-2009, Manchester United had Wayne Rooney, Cristiano Ronaldo, Carlos Tevez and Berbatov. And all four of them would walk into any of the top teams.
At
the
moment.
So there's been this general, perhaps, we're in the period of the cult of the coach, where the systems and the coach are more important than the top-class players. From there, somehow, Arteta has to get something a bit more out of his forwards. And on the recent show, that's not happening.
But even if we were talking about, because you're making a fascinating point there about forwards and the change in the game and how we're, you know, it's a more all-round forward player these days rather than a traditional striker. But also, it's confidence as well, isn't it? More than, you know, natural finishing ability. And if you were looking at Kai Havertz yesterday in that game, as well as maybe not having that instinctual, reactive, you know, moments that you need as a striker, he also looks completely gone in terms of confidence, doesn't he? There was one moment that Gregor and I were discussing before the show where he not only took a touch that he didn't need to, he took a touch and seemed to slow down and move further away from the goal.
Yeah.
It's like he was going to run to the corner flag to kill some time. It was completely bizarre.
He's played left back for Germany this year, yeah? Mm. That doesn't suggest he's a clinical finisher in a game of football. And I think he's okay. He's probably had more abuse this season than he merits. But he's not the answer to Arsenal win the title by playing him in that position. No. He's just going to keep missing and missing.
James Gilbrand's like written pieces as well, where he described him as a box crasher, which is what he was in German football before he came. And you know, almost a bit of a free role, but someone who arrived late into the box and finished that way. He's definitely not the one who's leading the line. And for talking about who they have, like, Jesus is a top class player, but whether he's the top class striker that Arsenal need, that, you know, to kind of borrow Ian Wright's little tweet the other day, is the killer in the box they need, is another question. And whether he's reliable enough and durable enough to last a Premier League campaign and be the man who's there for, you know, 80% of the games. He's not. That's been proven really consistently over recent years. So they need someone. It's not like there often these kind of narratives spring up out of, you know, a little bad run here and there, but this has been like abundantly clear for a long time that this is the kind of a major piece of the puzzle that Arsenal are lacking. And you know, Martin referenced Declan Rice's arrival, and he has made a big difference. It was not so long ago that was the kind of the conversation point we were having. He's made a massive difference in terms of like their defensive solidity and control, but going the other way, they're in a bit of a hole.
So do we think, going back to Alisson's point at the top about Arteta, are these comments not particularly helpful? Well, they were very helpful to me as editor yesterday when he came out and said them, because having watched the game and thought, how are we going to contrive this into a big story? I mean, Liverpool have won again, not really great for Arsenal. And then Gary Jacob rang in and said, Arteta said his team have got psychological problems. Fantastic, Gary, thanks so much. But they're not particularly helpful, are they, Gregor, as a player? If it's only going to, for players like Kai Havertz, if you're in the dressing room thinking, God, I really should have scored in that game, they're going to be on my back again, I can't check social media, and then your manager says that, that's only going to sow even more seeds of doubt, isn't it?
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I'm always slightly hesitant to, you know, sometimes think the language barrier might be something here. It's about, I'm not saying, he won't be thinking that they're all kind of got these neuroses about finishing. I think he'll be thinking that they need to be more kind of clear-headed and clinical, and I think that I feel that's what he means. But, and it probably could have been directed at Kai Havertz alone, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's not just about a striker too. The teams have kind of discovered if they shut down Martinelli and Saka, which is no mean feat and has been very difficult for teams to do for a long time. But if they're successful in doing that, then it leaves Arsenal in a massive hole. And Odegaard has not been anywhere near what he was last season. He had a little bit of a kind of return to form, but it's still not hitting the same heights. So when you take out the kind of attacking qualities of the three players behind the striker they don't have, they're in trouble.
It was an interesting game in terms of Liverpool's performance, because I thought it was a fantastic game and I think really enjoyable to watch. And as much as we'll go on to talk about the merits of the FA Cup and how seriously people take it, these two teams and many others put out decent sides, and a lot of star quality players, depending on the term of the use, star there, given our conversation. But Alisson, what did you make of Liverpool's performance? Because they themselves missed a lot of chances early in the first half. Darwin Núñez, perhaps not quite as guilty as Kai Havertz, but similar kind of worries about confidence, sharpness and clinical finishing. They do seem to have a little bit that of that mental resilience, perhaps, that Arsenal don't have this season under Jurgen Klopp. In that second half, I thought not just the changes, but there was a lot of like tactical fouls, a lot of yellow cards taken very happily. And I thought Trent Alexander-Arnold's celebration after the goal was scored from the corner seemed to say, yeah, we're well up for this.
Yeah, no, well, I was going to sort of say the same, in that they're in opposite places mentally, aren't they? And the first half was a barrage of Arsenal pressure. As a Liverpool fan, I wasn't bothered in the least. There's become a pattern now that no matter what happens in the first half with Liverpool, whether they play dominantly or not, they're going to be better in the second half. And there is a buoyancy about just their body language and the way they play that they believe they will get a way through, they will find a way through, and that if they've done anything that's below par, they will address it. I'd love to hear the entire halftime team talk these days that Klopp gives, because they do come out much, much better. He tweaks the team well. It's as though the players expect that to happen. And so they're, rather than being cowed by the fact they've faced so many shots, just, I don't know, you could argue it's slightly embarrassing. You're top of the league and it's bang, bang, bang. That's a bit silly. But no, they don't. They sort of, like those sort of machines in sci-fi films that sort of learn when you're not noticing. They sort of absorb what's happening and turn it on the opposition afterwards. And it's sort of like you've sort of felt that Liverpool were taunting Arsenal with how they played in the second half. You've done all that, but we're not the least bit upset by it. You've not disrupted our rhythm at all. This is something that we're quite happy to do. And of course, the stats about Liverpool scoring after the 75th minute, that, you know, that confidence that must give you as a striker, it's the exact opposite of what they're feeling in the Arsenal camp, isn't it? They're thinking, oh, it doesn't matter how many times we have a go, we're not going to get through. And Liverpool thinking, it doesn't matter how many times the opposition have a go, we'll find a way through at the end of the game.
Martin, in relation to some of the points Alisson made there, it's great to have you on the show, and you've made the long trip down from the North East. So I want always to make the most of having our reporters here and ask them the questions that I often always ask Gregor and Alisson and Martin Samuel and things. Looking at these two teams in the season as a whole, and thinking about like the title race, where do you see them? Obviously, you're quite critical of Arsenal's forward play. Do you see it as we were talking on Thursday with Johnny Northcroft and Martin Samuel about maybe it heading towards a two-horse title race between Liverpool and City? How are you seeing it? City, of course, with Kevin De Bruyne back as well.
First of all, more critical of Arsenal's forwards than forward play. Their forward play is good. They're just obviously not taking the chances, which comes back to loads of different things in terms of confidence and all that. If you were to say, who is the better team to watch, more interesting team to watch, you may say Arsenal, but if you were to put money on it, who is going to finish high, you would say Liverpool, I think. I still think it's a case of how many points you can get on Man City before Man City really get into their stride. Their stride may coincide with Kevin De Bruyne, it may coincide with the forwards becoming a bit fitter, Haaland having a spell without injury, maybe that's where it comes in, maybe there is a fitness legacy or an emotional legacy from doing the treble, which perhaps wears off in February, we'll see. I would still say if you finish above Man City, you win the league, and I don't think Liverpool are good enough to do that yet. I think they are growing in belief, which I agree with exactly with what Ali says. Odegaard's shot goes in on another day and Liverpool perhaps get beat. Liverpool play at St James's Park early in the season, and Newcastle are the better team with 11v11 and then perhaps the better team when Van Dijk's been sent off. And at 1-0, Almiron's shot is... Alisson saves it, bounces off the crossbar, bounces off his head, doesn't go in, it's not 2-0, and then Darwin Núñez hits two of his 76 shots that actually go on target and go in the net, and Liverpool have won, and they take a massive bounce from that. as they will have done last night. So each time they do it, they keep growing. But again, not to appear too curmudgeonly, this team Liverpool have now would get beaten pretty comfortably, I think, by the Liverpool team that won the title a few years ago, because I just think they were better. This is still a work in progress by Nunes playing as a central striker, and I wouldn't trust him. Again, if you were to say to Arsenal, pick a player that's going to win you the title as a goal scorer, you wouldn't look at Darwin Nunes, and he gets moved out wide in the second half, which perhaps gives him a bit more impact because there's not as much pressure on him. He actually
they have Salah.
Sorry?
They have Salah.
Yeah, they have Salah. That's the difference. Actually, Nunes looks like an Arsenal forward. That's probably the biggest insult I could say. You just wouldn't trust them to score a goal like you needed to. But they are getting more and more confident. They're much more difficult to beat than last season. Players are starting to develop. So I do think they'll give Man City a run for the money. And a lot of that is confidence. And then you saw them play against Newcastle on New Year's Day. And they just had so much power in the team. Then you thought that's starting to look a little bit more like a Jurgen Klopp team. Was the XG 7.1 or something? Mm. 18 shots to 1 at half time. And that's Newcastle like to play that Liverpool style, but they just got a bit blown away. So you can see the development from August to January and how they are progressing, but I still think there's a long way to go.
Tom, yeah. You mentioned that you enjoyed the fact that there were two strong teams put out. And one reason that Liverpool did that was it was just really important for this period coming up that they show they can win without Mo Salah. Really important. Yeah. So you would deliberately. We're talking about what managers do to improve the psyche of the team. That mattered a lot because everyone would have... people were not talking about Mo Salah during that game because it was... It didn't... Obviously, you're never not going to miss him, but it didn't matter. And that was so important.
Yeah, well, you say that. Well, at 0-0, that was my idea for a back page, was talking about Mo Salah and the absence, and look what happens when he goes away. No one can score a goal, but thankfully Luis Diaz and an own goal came up trumps. Moving on to the Stadium of Light and the other big game of the weekend, and Martin Hardy, the reason you are here, Sunderland against Newcastle.
I'm only here because I heard there was free beer.
Oh, that's true. Well, we'll come on to the free beer in a second. But I wanted to talk about before the match, because we were incredibly excited about this match and you and I worked on a piece which was absolutely fantastic from yourself. Tell us a bit more about that piece and why this fixture ultimately makes people in the North East a bit crazy.
Blimey, where do I start on that one? I think it was when people realised that Sunderland had allowed a company to put up signs that said Black and White Army and changed the spelling. This actually proves how ridiculous the derby is, the fact that the people from Sunderland spell away with an apostrophe and an A, and people from the not from Newcastle spell it with an O. Sunderland had let a company come in and put this up inside the Black Cats bar where Newcastle had tickets for, and you forget Sunderland had been a League One and a Championship team, and it was like, here, we can take some Newcastle's money, and you're probably talking about a couple of £100,000. But then, of course, people realised that you are desecrating your home with your greatest rivals' banners, and at this point, everybody in Sunderland goes berserk, and it's like, this is on Thursday afternoon night, now it's starting to feel like a Sunderland-Newcastle game again. Crazy stuff starting to happen, and you just, we go through the recollection of Ruud Gullit picking a white van driver ahead of Alan Shearer and Duncan Ferguson. You then go back to a man punching a horse, saying he regrets it because he loves animals and he feeds the foxes over the road, and his wife then saying he doesn't usually go out on his own, and look what happens when he does. And all the elements of it, Paolo Di Canio sliding on his knees and then saying afterwards he'd been visited by his dead mother, a vision of his dead mother in the visiting changing room at St James's Park. So the list went on and on and on of these crazy stories. I think it did prove the kind of Sunderland weren't ready for such a big fixture. But then we move it forward to the game. It's a bubble game, so you have 6,000 fans coming across from Newcastle. And we thought it would be chaotic, so I went to St James's Park before the match, and it was brilliantly organised in terms of you had a queue probably about half a mile long, everybody quite patiently, the odd person drinking a bottle of Corona at about 8:15 in the morning. Buses came in, everyone got a free scarf, which is a brilliant idea by somebody at Newcastle, because the colour, the visual colour inside the stadium, especially after match when Newcastle do their controversial team photograph in front of these fans, it really did look like Newcastle had conquered Sunderland that day by the finish. And to cap it all off in the bars, as the buses wait to take 6,000 people back to Tyneside, a lot of fans had to wait, obviously, because the buses were kind of rolling in and rolling out. Sunderland very politely had left the bars open, but unfortunately everything at the Stadium of Light went wrong that day. The Wi-Fi went off. It's a cashless stadium. In a bid to help give beer to the Newcastle fans, six members of staff in each bar were basically just pouring beer. So when you went to give your order to one of the other members of staff, they would go, 5 pints, yes, they're there. By which time the Wi-Fi goes off, they can't take the cash. They then say to Newcastle fans, just take them for nothing. And that kind of, if anything, kind of summarised just how bad a week Sunderland have had, that was it. They are now giving beer to Newcastle fans for nothing.
That probably stings more, doesn't it, for a Sunderland fan than the actual defeat in the match, giving away free beer to your rival fans.
On the train down, having written that story and put it on our fine website, I did have a couple of Sunderland fans who, and we are usually more at kind of relaxed in conversation, their tone was a little bit prickly.
Yes, I would say so. Coming on to the match itself, Alison, we were talking about this before, having read Martin's piece and got all excited.
Yes,
it's a Saturday.
I was very excited.
Saturday lunchtime, you know, I sat down to watch that first half, and Sunderland have been a team that I've enjoyed watching in the past, particularly under Tony Mowbray. I thought they played some really exciting and attractive football to watch. It was a bizarre approach to this game from Michael Beale, wasn't it, Alison?
Well, I don't know. He's not been there long enough, maybe. I don't know. It was... what do you do in a cup tie against a team in the division above who better than you? You try and make it equal in other ways. I don't know. You play the sort of rough and tumble football that they might not be used to. You give it everything. You're aggressive. Don't try and play pretty football, because Newcastle can play prettier football than you. They were in some sort of dream world where they thought they were equal.
Mm.
And in some way, showing you're equal isn't about the result. Showing you're equal is about, we can play football too.
Yeah. Tony Cascarino talked in his column about the standing off players like Bruno Guimarães, and that, you hear players talk about it all the time, and Greg, I'm sure you could shed more light on this, that idea that in that scenario, and you saw it, every Sunderland fan was stood up, which only happens either when you think there's a goal or a corner, but they were stood up for the whole opening, 20 minutes maybe? And so they're desperate for something to latch onto. And instead, the Sunderland players are standing off Bruno Guimarães going, pick your pass, mate, don't worry, give it a bit of time. Martin, what was the atmosphere like in the ground?
The atmosphere was brilliant. The kind of... the pantomime during of the coaches that came in, and the Newcastle coaches, they wound their way through the Sunderland fans, and it felt symbolic that the first person off the bus was a 6'7" Geordie from Blyth, Dan Byrne, just laughing his head off. I thought, yeah, you've sent your hardest bloke out first and he's all right with this. And that did carry on, but the atmosphere at the start was brilliant. The one thing Celtic and Rangers has completely lost is that colour element. For the neutral, you would watch 8,000 fans either tucked away in a corner of Parkhead, or 8,000 behind the goals at Ibrox, and red, white and blue, and then green, white and orange, and it would give you this brilliant contrast. So that's what the ground had. It was just red and white wherever you looked, apart from 6,000 people defiantly holding the scarves up. So the atmosphere was brilliant at the start. What I would say was, if you were a Newcastle fan, and this probably with hindsight, would you rather Michael Beale was the coach for Sunderland, or would you rather have Sam Allardyce in? And I think you would say Sam Allardyce every day of the week, whether or not you're his biggest fan. He would have went, right, don't play out from the back, because they love to press and they've had a week to get themselves fit again, whereas they've struggled because of the three games. And they may have to alter the style going forward because it physically demanded too much of the players. This time the players had a week of rest, and Sunderland kept playing out from the back and gave away a goal after 31 seconds in the second half. They'd even been an offside and they still went back, and the player gets caught. Newcastle have had a weakness in that hold and roll position in front of the two centre-halves, because Guimarães just has to do so much. He holds and he more or less plays as a number 10. It was only when they finally moved Alex Pritchard in that position in the second half they had some success. Agree with what Ali said, it looked like Michael Beale was coaching to say, I can do what Eddie Howe does, I'm a very modern coach, look at this. And he thought, this isn't about Michael Beale, this is about Sunderland trying desperately to kind of arrest their slide over the last few years by doing something against Newcastle. And they just about did nothing. Newcastle took control very, very early, and Bob, maybe 5 minutes in the second half, never really give that away. And it did feel like Sunderland's errors start with the bar, the signs, the tactics, the beer. It just seems like they weren't ready for this game.
Gregor, what did you make of all those points?
Yeah, pragmatists are a dying breed though, aren't they? That's why you got the job, to say, this is the way I play, this is, I've stamped my authority on the team, and part of the cool philosophy of the club now is to sign young players and develop them in a certain way. And so I suppose it does follow that that's the way they'll approach every game. But it's true, they were just then that sort of, the gulf was so clear. And it was also a bit of a hybrid between, as you say, standing off and showing too much respect and not doing the things, the competitiveness and the, combativeness even in a derby, and then trying to play it from the back. So it was like, when they had the ball, they were trying to play in a certain way, but when they didn't have the ball, they didn't show any of the sort of fight that their team wanted, that their fans want and expect in a derby game.
In terms of Newcastle's performance, Martin, you've written a piece on the Times website today talking about Kieran Trippier and the difficulties he's had, but how this match gave him maybe a platform to improve and go forward and forget that troublesome period.
No, absolutely. And him missing against Liverpool, I had thought and was kind of hearing he will be fit for Sunderland, even though there was a bit of question mark. And I thought this is the perfect game to bring him back in for as a leader, as one of the best players. And he kind of, I think he crossed the ball twice in the first 2 minutes, taking a corner, faced the abuse of Sunderland fans, which he took for the whole game. But everything he did was correct in terms of when he went long, when he went short, how he led the team. And he is an essential part of Newcastle playing well, so they need him back. He's only had one bad month, in fairness, since, and it was 2 years yesterday that Newcastle signed him. There's the first signing after the takeover. And he's, you know, pound for pound, one of the best signings. I think Newcastle fans would say that they've bought in decades, if not ever. But his run kind of coincided with the team conking out and losing confidence, losing a bit of steam. So the way he played suggests that, and Eddie Howe said this after the game, it's potentially a springboard. They've got another break till Man City of, what, 6-7 days. And inside the club, it was kind of win the derby, try and get something out of Man City, and is it 15-day rest before Villa, or a 2-week rest before the Villa game, in which time they hope to kind of recharge their batteries again and get ready to go. So yeah, it was important for him, and you can see the celebrations he did on his own, never mind the team photo. He was just fists clenched, he was winding up the Sunderland fans by the finish point of the scoreboard when it was 2-0, deliberately putting the ball outside the section when he's taking a corner, all those kind of things. Which, and when you watch good players at their best, and Virgil van Dijk does this sometimes, it's kind of, I think it's now, they will go to an opponent, it's like, I think it's now my turn to have the ball back, thank you, I can take it off you whichever way you want, we can make this a fight, or you can give it me simply, and that's how he played on Saturday.
Yeah. Do you think he's almost kind of, this match and his performance was slightly symbolic of where Newcastle's season
was
100%. At? You know, you had mischievous editors like me and James talking to you going, Eddie Howe's in a bit of trouble here, isn't he, if he loses this game. All that talk is gone now.
Well,
they've got a break.
Mischievous editors or Newcastle fans in the northeast who would, and maybe this is the same everywhere, but it feels like it's unique in that. In Newcastle, if you go to Sainsbury's, you've got the shop, if you walk down the street, everybody pesters you for a bit of what's happening, who are they signing, and that never stops.
Are you famous then? Are you that famous? Are you going to supermarkets and people know who you are?
I can't say on air that there was one good part of COVID, but the good thing would perhaps be that you could put a mask on and you weren't allowed to speak to anybody when you're trying to do your shopping, so you could get it done in 20 minutes instead of standing there for 2 hours with people you see once every 2 years and they want to know who they're about to sign and what's happening with the tactics. So the conversations leading up to the derby were, oh, it's wrong, people are putting pressure on Eddie, he's done brilliant, but he better win the derby. Yeah. So they said exactly the same as yourself, and in conversation with Eddie, it was like he wanted control, and perhaps that they are learning from certain elements of this season. They made a mistake, I think, in not going to AC Milan before the match to train at the San Siro. They got delayed. They were late for the first press conference in the European Cup for 20 years. By the finish at Paris, they were training on the pitch the day before the game. So there's little elements they've learned. The club is learning as well at the same time. And that big thing for Eddie Howe is control of the game, control of all the aspects, control of the emotion. And they had that on Saturday. But it was a really important win for him.
How annoying for Sunderland fans, though. They've kick-started... Put Newcastle back on track. They've saved their season. Not just lost.
I've bumped into certain Newcastle fans Saturday night memories and certainly on Sunday, and they're just these huge smiles because for lots of different reasons. The bad run against Sunderland of 9 games without beating them has gone. That line in the sand's done. It kickstarts Newcastle's season. If you'd been really harsh, you'd say, I'm not quite sure when they're going to play each other again. I can't see Sunderland getting promoted in the short term. People have said Luton, and I've said, well, Luton's home ground seems like that was a big, big factor in that promotion. And Luton went very physical to get out of the division, where Sunderland, you saw them lining up for the wall, and they're not a big team. No. And it was like Tony Mowbray's Diddy men last season. Yeah. But they were passed the ball really well and they were nice to watch. But this season, they seem to be a little bit lost.
Remain to be convinced that swapping Tony Mowbray for McBeal was
yes.
the right choice.
No,
well,
absolutely.
As we were saying, Tony Mowbray had just been given the Birmingham City job. We will see if they go past each other in the Championship over the coming months. Big pressure on Michael Beale. Game podcast listeners, I've always say get in touch with me over email, but it turns out if you see Martin Hardy in the street, make sure you go up to him, tell him how much you enjoyed him on the show. Stick with us, because as well as Martin Hardy's revelations about his personal life as a journalist, we'll also be talking about replays in the next part of the show, and we'll also be asking, where would you like see Kylian Mbappe in the Premier League. Stick with us.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Alison Rudd, Martin Hardy and Gregor Robertson. Now, one of the big talking points of this third round was replays, but before we get into that debate, which I'm sure will be a heated one, I wanted us to pick out some of the other moments that caught our eye. Gregor, I'm going to start with you, because I think I know where you're going to go.
It has to be Maidstone United, yeah. They'd already overcome Barrow, who are flying high in League Two. And this wasn't obviously the kind of plum draw that they would have dreamt of against Stevenage, but it gave them a chance in their kind of compact stadium, artificial pitch. And, you know, they rode their luck a little bit towards the end, but it's a great story for a club that obviously was kind of reborn in 1992 and now seems to be run really kind of prudently. I think they've turned a profit in 10 consecutive seasons. And they have George Ellacobe as manager, who's a great character.
Absolutely. What a brilliant interview after the game as well. Yeah. So many brilliant interviews after the game.
Yeah, and he's played at every level, the top six tiers in English football and scored in them all. Obviously most notable for his time at Wolves, with whom he played in the Premier League. But he's really, his enthusiasm is kind of infectious, and his smile and his joy at the end of the game. So I really hope they get a good draw in the next round.
Well, I don't know whether being a goalkeeper in my six-a-side team puts me in the goalkeepers union, but I'm going to do it for this point anyway. Cameron Dawson, the Sheffield Wednesday goalkeeper, saving 2 penalties in 3 minutes in the opening stages of their 4-0 win against Cardiff. Wednesday cruising to that victory, and it's quite easy to forget if you save two penalties. So well done to Cameron Dawson. Anyone else get any moments from the third round?
That was hilarious, Tom. I don't know. That was like complete comedy slapstick FA Cup third round football. You shouldn't laugh when people have every shot saved and penalty saved, and it was. I loved it. It was very, very funny. It was very funny. But I think for a lot of people, and maybe it's young people. I mean, maybe the FA Cup is for old people. I don't know, but
that's okay, because there's plenty of us.
Yes,
we need something.
No one's old on this podcast.
I don't know. I don't know if very young people are that excited by the FA Cup in the way that older generations were. Because, you know, the classic is it was the only football you saw on telly, so it really, really mattered. And now it's everywhere. But kids watch clips as opposed to sit down. I mean, I've got a nephew who refuses to watch live football. While live football's on, he'll be watching feeds of other things. He doesn't... The concept of concentrating on a live match seems anathema to him. It's very strange. But anyway, the thing that was getting young people excited was Patrick Bamford's goal. And the fact that came in a sort of old-fashioned-looking FA Cup tie was lovely. And also, it didn't look like Patrick Bamford, so a lot of people would have been saying, who's that wonderful striker who scored that goal? I mean, never seen him before because he just looked unrecognisable with his new hair and beard and everything.
His Joe Linton hair.
It was strange, wasn't it? But it was a beautiful goal. And it's that thing of a single movement. You control the ball on your chest and swivel and it's unstoppable. And you know that you can't say, wasn't a great goalkeeper. No goalkeeper would have stopped it. It was just stunning.
Well, I love the big away followings, and it's perhaps journalist to say the FA Cup will die. The FA Cup will never die, even if it's 16 non-league teams playing it. It will still have survived in some shape or form. But when you see the big away followings, you see what it means. So for there to be 9,000 Bristol City fans at West Ham was absolutely brilliant. Then you've got 6,000, which we've mentioned, Newcastle fans at Liverpool. Sorry, at Sunderland rather. So those big followings proves it does still mean something to somebody. And to see the club, the colours, all of that, the magic of the day, that's the highlight for me, seeing these big...
I'll say Chesterfield at Watford as well. Mm. They were so close to...
They were so close.
To getting a replay, a bit even more than that. The way they play, they're earning points at a faster rate than Wrexham and Notts County did last season, in that record-breaking season at the top of the National League. And they went and they were wiping the floor with Watford. And Watford... One big thing is the ability of teams now to make five subs. You know, if a team's made a raft of changes and you get towards the later stages of a game and a team like Watford are behind against a National League club and they throw in the cavalry, it can have a major effect. So, I'm not happy about that.
Go back to one sub for FA Cup ties.
Now we really are going back down. I told you, we're not old on this podcast, but you're making yourself sound very, very old. They were talking about one subs. Talking about Bristol City and their point, not point, but getting a draw at West Ham, Martin. But leads me nicely on to talk about replays. And I'm going to read some quotes from various managers. Thomas Frank talking about their 1-1 draw with Wolves and the replay. This is the worst outcome in every respect. I said it yesterday. I simply don't understand why we have a replay. Nuno Espirito Santo talking about their 2-2 draw with Blackpool. It changes the plan. Now we have to reorganise and we won't get a break because the priority is the replay. Now what is best for the team is to start preparing for that replay. That is the priority. That is unfortunate. Neil Critchley, the Blackpool manager, on the other hand. This was our 35th game of the season. The Premier League teams haven't played that. They get international breaks, time off. We don't. Get on with it. Look at the resources, the finance, the staffing. We don't have that. It's tough. Get on with it. Let's play football. Ian Evatt, after their 0-0 draw. Ian Evatt, the Bolton manager, after their 0-0 draw with Luton. This club has really suffered. We almost lost the club in 2019. To get it back to where we want, it requires revenue and an FA Cup replay. Hopefully a full house and a TV game goes a long way. So...
Can I start with an anecdote here from when Liverpool
played? Of course you can.
Liverpool played away against LASK, so the day before, with several Liverpool journalists in Lynn's having a bite to eat. And it was when Harry Maguire was getting a lot of grief from the fans, and Gareth Southgate said he'd never seen anything like this. And so I was sat and I went, I can remember a game at Villa Park where all you could hear was Adams is a donkey, Adams is a donkey. And it was Liverpool against Arsenal. And I was like, was it a FA Cup semi-final? And he went through his brain, he went... No, he said it was a League Cup replay. So in 1988, first game at Anfield, the replay then goes to Highbury. Now, if it was a draw at that stage, and I'd forgotten all this, it would then go to a neutral venue. So the third game between the teams, again midweek, was at Villa Park when 21,000 people turned up. And we all said, imagine if you had to say to Jurgen Klopp, now we've got to go and have a replay on a neutral venue, his head probably would have exploded. So you are talking about a cultural change. However, the one thing I thought on the way down, the removal of the replay makes the game really poor because some teams will go, we're here for a penalty shootout. And you get this really bland version. I think Leicester did it to Newcastle last season in the League Cup. All they were there for was the penalty shootout and to go home. So it does change the dynamic dramatically. I understand teams playing too many games. The Lord, I don't like that argument from... Alan Shearer's done. I didn't like it from here when he said, oh, you're a footballer, play football. It's not like that now for the top level players. The physicality is so intense to keep them playing games. However, the removal of the replay alters the game dramatically and makes it really poor sometimes.
Well, Martin Ziegler, in early December, in his column that runs every Friday on the Times website, was reporting that FA Cup third and fourth round replays are likely to be scrapped as FA Chiefs want the mid-season break kept intact. And with an expanded Champions League and new international calendar set to put fixtures under pressure.
But there are two separate issues here. The reason these guys, I hope the reason people like Thomas Frank and Nuno are complaining is because they don't have the winter break now. That's why they complain. Because they have no grounds to complain whatsoever. As you said, Neil Critchley said, 35th game of the season, I think it was Forest 22nd.
Yeah.
why would Forrest be complaining about they've not they went out again in the first game against Burnley in the EFL Cup, a game I was at, which I will never get. There was 90 minutes back in my life. It was horrific. So they're straight out of that cup. I know they want to concentrate on Premier League survival, but come on, like, they have nothing to complain about. Most teams in the country, and sorry, in the Premier League, have nothing to complain about. So this whole conversation, it's all about, you know, we spend a disproportionate like amount of our lives listening to elite managers whine about how many games they're playing. And so the idea was we shape the football calendar for those 6 to 8 teams, like forget about everyone else, is absolutely nonsense. It's just
to Martin's point about the kind of game management and stuff, I think I've asked you this before, but I always like to reiterate it. When you were playing, did this idea of the calendar and busy fixtures ever come up in the dressing room amongst you and your fellow players of like, oh God, it's a bit much, isn't it? I'm a bit tired. Did that ever come up?
I mean, the only time was the Christmas period, which, you know, it can be a lot. What were there? I think in the Football Leagues, some of the teams had like 4 games in 10 days or something. So yeah, Christ, you were tired. But it was part of the tradition. That's part of like, you know, the challenge of getting results was overcoming that fatigue and fighting through it and getting results. I know it's different at the top level, but Critchley was right. The resources are different. Just change your team. Prioritise. Like, the idea that we should change the football calendar, as I'll say it again, for 6 to 8 teams, completely ignoring what the rest of the teams in the pyramid want. You know, like Ian Evatt, as you say there, was pointing out, you either earn a replay on your own patch, which is like something great to look forward to, or you're earning a trip to a big stadium. That's generally what we're talking about, and that's huge for so many clubs, not just financially, but like in terms of making memories and stuff as well. So I mean, I understand the argument, because it's like a half-arsed winter break now we have. Like, so how some teams, because they've, you know, drawn a game in the FA Cup, get a rest and some don't, is a nonsense. But so that's something that's up for discussion. But the idea that most Premier League teams are complaining about having replays more generally is just ridiculous.
But but I have some sympathy with Thomas Frank in that he's juggling limited resources at the moment. I mean, you know, the international duty of his various players, his best players have been injured or suspended. But he's had to think, okay, I've got to plan somehow a way to make sure we stay in the Premier League, and how he's planned for the winter break, how he's get the best out of it, where he goes, what they do, the whole ambience of that, what you do to try and reset so that you can come back after a sort of dismal run, is completely thrown in the air because there's a replay.
I agree.
It's not. I think that's it's reasonable to complain about that.
Get rid of the winter break or do it properly. Just have a weekend off. Like, they've staggered it over 2 weekends so that the broadcasters still have games to put on the TV. If you know, they don't miss out for a weekend. Do it properly and give everyone a weekend off. And don't rearrange FA Cup replays in the winter break.
Yeah, but this is also the problem, isn't it? Because as I said when I was reading out that Martin Ziegler piece from early in December, it's talking about an expanded Champions League, more international fixtures, and as Gregor, you're saying there, TV fixtures for the top clubs. It's piling it up all at the top, and then these clubs in the EFL are not going to get anything. And this also comes on the back of another Martin Ziegler piece last week. The Premier League will be summoned to appear before MPs later this month to explain the delay in agreeing a financial settlement with the EFL. The move reflects growing pressure in Whitehall for a funding deal to be concluded with a number of EFL clubs in financial difficulties. The EFL has argued a financial reset is needed to close the increasing financial gap with the Premier League. If we're getting rid of replays, Ian Evatt and Bolton and Neil Critchley and Blackpool are just going to get even less money.
Yeah, but they shouldn't have to. It's fate who you draw out the hat in the FA Cup. You can't rely
on
fate
not.
Giving you a good financial run in the FA Cup to get out of trouble.
But it has been for a long time, and my club included, we in the run when we got promoted, but also had that great run under the Cowley brothers. Lincoln drew at Portman Road against Ipswich and then got a replay at Sinsel Bank, which was on telly. And we won 1-0, and then off we go. If that's not a replay, maybe we go to extra time and penalties at Portman Road. A couple of National League players aren't quite up to taking a penalty shootout in front of a load of Ipswich fans. We lose. That money that we made from that season, basically set up the club for what happened after it, another promotion, and where we are now in League One.
I completely see Ali's point there, which is kind of like you're doing your year's financial plan, and you say, well, if we win the lottery, we'll be all right.
Yeah, that's it.
If not,
but that's sadly a lot of the state of where a lot of NFL clubs are.
So we should be looking after them better rather than letting them rely on romance. Oh, yeah, we've got the romance of the cup, might save you.
Yeah, but then what we're saying is, right, we'll give you some more money, guys, if you just knock all the replays in the head. It's like,
yeah.
But the big thing about leaving the stadium, like when the Newcastle fans are singing "We'll meet again," don't know where, don't know when. Someone's Wi-Fi went off. The ground is empty. They outsource the signage. All that stuff is a club that's got no money.
Yeah,
and they're playing a club that has got money.
That Sunderland would be seen, so say, to Lincoln City fans or to Bolton fans or even Blackpool fans. Some of those fans of those clubs might argue with me, but Sunderland, a bigger club,
you
know, with greater aspirations, you know, signing young players, Jude Bellingham's brother, etc., etc. And but you're saying that's a club with no money.
Yeah, but so, that top elite are moving further and further away. So that was the big feel at the end of the game. It was like these two teams might not play each other for a very long time, bar an exceptional circumstance like a cup tie or a one-season promotion. So what's the future for Sunderland and Middlesbrough and Sheffield Wednesday and Stoke and all these teams that traditionally are big clubs, but they're being left in the slipstream of either the elite, which is Liverpool, Man United, or those that have managed to tag in there, like probably Chelsea and Newcastle.
But I would argue that those clubs that you've just listed there are actually now tipping into a different category of, say, big championship club whose aspirations are promotion to the big money in the Premier League, who would actually maybe go, as much as Sunderland fans, I'm sure you would say, oh, I've hated it, it was the worst day weekend in the season. If you then come to them at the end and say, let's say Michael Beale does turn it around and they get in the playoffs, they'll be like, yeah, we'll probably take that defeat against Newcastle in the cup. Maybe I'm wrong. But I'm talking more about the clubs even further down the pyramid, League Two, who are bluntly never really going to make it to the Premier League unless there's a Wrexham kind of story. And I take your point, Alison, that there should be something better, but it just feels to me, maybe this is cynical, maybe it's just realistic, that actually what we're going to do is just take away that lottery moment.
No, I think it needs
and
to
not
stay,
replace it with anything else.
Yeah.
Really.
Part of the magic of the cup is, I have just won the lottery.
Yeah,
and I wasn't expecting it. And like, well, 100 grand. Some clubs blow it. Some clubs invest in the stadium, youth, or whatever. And the money is really, really important. You can feel for 10 years. That is the essence of the FA Cup and the magic of it. And the replay, as you say, is, you know, earning a replay. It would be awful. It used to be awful when they would change the games from their downtrodden little non-league stadium to play the first tie at the bigger team's ground just for the financial element. Well, no. Play it, get them in the small dressing rooms, have all that magic, the crap pitch, all that stuff that you grew up with, as long as it's not Ronnie Radford, of course. All those elements are what makes the cup tie, and that's why you grab a hold of it. And the financial thing, it's a lottery win. You can't plan for it, but when it comes, it's supposed to cheer you up.
I was just talking to Tom earlier before we came on about a team in Scotland called the Spartans, who've drawn Hearts. And Spartans are like a really sort of upwardly mobile, great community little club, but their history is in junior non-league football. And Hart said, do you want to play, you know, we can play the game at our stadium. They said, no, come to our patch. And the fact that they can possibly, you know, do something special. Yeah. So it's about creating those memories as well. It's not just about money, but because part of it is earning either, as I say, a trip to a big stadium, but you earned it.
Yeah.
Or bring them back to your patch where you think we've got a good chance here now.
The third round piece that we all did, all the journalists from the Times said, give us a great memory from the third round FA Cup. I chose Whitley Bay in this kind of in the second round. I cheated a little bit. Whitley Bay beat Preston North End at Hillheads. Only because the third round game was so grim. Okay, 1,500 Whitley Bay fans went to Preston, to Rochdale for the day, got beat 1-0. It was a terrible game. But the second round game, the magic of the cup, there's 5,000 at Hillheads, which there's never been before and there's never been since. Loads of people of how many years ago, so it was 1990, were on the pitch. It gave a huge boost to Whitley Bay. Before the match, it was at the time when Durham Wasps and Whitley Warriors ice hockey teams were really successful and huge and getting 3,000 or 4,000. So they went, did a video of a Whitley Bay game when there was like 300 people there, and they used the commentary from the ice hockey games, which used to feature on Grandstand. So you just got this huge magic that people won't ever forget. The ground's not changed a great deal. The pitch was quite heavy. Tom Finney was on the pitch before the game. So there's all those moments in the FA Cup of playing at the small grounds, which is an absolutely essential part of it.
But talking about money, Martin Samuel's written his column on the Times website this morning, just talking about cups in general and in replays. The winner of the Carabao Cup receives £100,000. The winner of the FA Cup gets £2 million. But the single point that separated Bournemouth in 15th place last season and Nottingham Forest in 16th was worth £2.2 million. So when it comes to these clubs in the Premier League, I mean, even talking about the big clubs, Martin, you cover Newcastle, Alison, you're a Liverpool fan. Do these cup competitions, and you're going to say, oh, it's because we're old, that's why it matters, but do they matter in the same way? If I was to offer you the chance to say, right, we won't be in the Carabao Cup then, you can leave that. You can leave that to every team below the coefficient of whatever, say, from everyone from Everton and West Ham downwards, they can compete for the Carabao Cup and it'll have incentivised for something else. Would you take that? Or do you want to be in it because it's a trophy and it's nice to win a trophy?
No, I think it's deeply patronising to say let the hoi polloi have it. I mean, the reason any cup has a passion behind it is because of the possibility you might cause an upset against one of the very biggest clubs. And if they're not in it to start with, then who cares anyway? And I think you have a duty as a big club to take it seriously, actually.
And play your replays.
Well,
Newcastle United under Matt,
they're changing the rules on the replays. So there's no replay in the fifth round this year.
No.
Newcastle and Mike actually had a meeting of the members of their board with the fans, because the whole thing was such a catastrophe, and sat there and said, we've done a study and teams like Wigan, who did well in the FA Cup, got relegated a year or two afterwards and it's financially damaging, so we're not going to do anything in the FA Cup. And that killed the FA Cup. So Newcastle never won third round ties for ages, and the club became as close as you could to getting becoming pointless. You want to finish fourth or fifth bottom in the Premier League, you've got no interest whatsoever in the Cups. What are we all doing coming here? And eventually, it's happened about three times since the war, Newcastle's support dropped off and Mike actually has to find 10,000 season tickets because the fans have gone, this is all irrelevant. So you have to have a cup tie, you have to have some glory in your season. Sunderland, who were more chaotic in that period, actually reached the League Cup final and had a good first half against Man City, and they give their supporters a semi-final. Remember the semi-final win at Man United and the penalty shootout? They had the drama of being a football fan. Otherwise, what's the point?
Quite right.
Just fundamentally, though, the most important thing I think to remember in this is that domestic football should not be shaped in the image desired by six or eight teams in the country.
Quite right, Kruger. I think there's lots of problems that we've highlighted. I'm not sure we've got any solutions. Listeners, if you have solutions to the FA Cup replay money spinning conundrum, do get in touch. tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. We're going to finish away from the FA Cup with two big transfer stories which broke on the Times website over the weekend. On Saturday, we had Paul Joyce reporting that Jordan Henderson wants to leave Saudi Arabia already. After only 6 months, what happened to changing the culture, eh, Jordan? And on Sunday, Duncan Castles wrote that Kylian Mbappe is unhappy at Real Madrid's attempts to sign him and might consider the Premier League. So we're not going to debate it. We're not going to argue over it. We're not going to get into any deep philosophical footballing chats. We're just going to have a bit of fun. You've got Jordan Henderson and Kylian Mbappe up for grabs. Find them a club in the Premier League. Alison Rudd, don't say Liverpool.
Good luck.
No, I'm bored with Kylian Mbappe. He just seems more spoiled by the minute.
So you're going to send
honest.
Him to Luton?
I think I don't know. I don't know what the boy deserves, to be quite honest. I really don't. 1 minute, his dream, his love, his passion is Real Madrid, and now he's annoyed with them, and they can't dictate what he does with his life. I mean, make your blooming mind up. It'd be fun to have him in the Premier League, but the Premier League doesn't need him.
So you don't even want him? I'm offering you Kylian Mbappe for any 20 clubs.
I don't want him.
I'm going to get lots of emails. What about Jordan Henderson? Who could you see him? Because I think I was discussing this with Tony Cascarino for his column, and he was saying how he wasn't the only big stalwart to leave Liverpool in the summer. James Milner, of course, left as well. Milner does a very James Milner thing and goes to Brighton and is playing, and Roberto De Zerbi this week's praising him, saying he can break the appearances record, and now you've got Jordan Henderson stuck with £300,000 a week. But you'd imagine, wouldn't you, in the summer, that maybe Jordan Henderson would have had many suitors in the Premier League for a player of his experience and class. Is there anyone, forgetting the money, think of a club for Jordan Henderson?
Well, I think if he wants to rebuild his image, he should go to Sunderland. I don't know, Martin, would Sunderland have him?
They couldn't afford him.
He's too old, isn't he, as well, for Sunderland's model.
He's too tall.
He's accrued so much in his short time in the Saudi Pro League that he can afford to take a massive salary.
He needs to pay a massive chunk in tax if he comes back.
Oh, you're being too realist. We're just having some fun. Could he go? So Alison's sending him to Newcastle. Martin Hardy.
No,
killing him.
Sunderland,
sorry.
Well, he plays for a team in Saudi Arabia.
I was just going to say.
Die in the wood, Sunderland lad, Sunderland fan. So obviously, send him to St James's Park.
That's his real penance.
as a sitting midfielder in the absence of Tonali.
You could do far
worse.
I'm trying to think
whether he's playing for one of the PIF clubs in the Public Investment Fund for in Saudi Arabia to see if that could actually happen. The salary would be a problem. Yeah, I think I would disagree. I think the Premier League desperately needs, not desperately, really could do with Kylian Mbappe. We're short of stars. The league is short of stars. It's too coachy. Get a big plane. Put him at Man.
Too coachy.
Put him at Man United.
Oh, so you want to destroy Kylian Mbappe?
Sure that the vortex can even suck him into though.
Make that madness even more chaotic, and make Man United relevant again at the top level. I'd love to see Mbappe play far more than I do. That, and obviously we've had a glimpse of him in Paris, watching Newcastle play there, and he's a fantastic player. I'd love to see him in the Premier League.
Interesting that you say that you worry about Newcastle fans coming up to talk to you about your columns and things, having just said they should sign Jordan Henderson. We'll see how that goes.
I nearly didn't say that.
Too late now, you've said it. Gregor, finish with you.
Snubbed in the milk aisle. I'll tell you that.
I think we're doing him a disservice. I think every team from West Ham, you take out, he's not going to go to United or Newcastle for the obvious reason, or Chelsea.
Now, forget all that, but just genuinely, like,
I'm serious. Anyone. I think every other team from West Ham and sixth down would take Jordan Henderson.
Pick one. Go on.
All of them.
No, pick one.
He can move to Newcastle.
The game's to pick one.
He can go to Newcastle.
Pick one. I think West Ham would take him.
Great.
In a heartbeat.
Now where's Mbappe going?
As soon as Alisson, didn't want to get into this, I think the synergy is with Liverpool. Absolutely. A wide forward, dynamic, in your face, front foot football. I think that's Liverpool.
Terrifying prospects. Listeners, if you've got any ideas about where Jordan Henderson or Kylian Mbappe should go, get in touch. tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Martin Hardy, Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. We'll be back on Thursday. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.